We turn now to the subject of advanced directives. And I should state right away my own bias that I think advanced directives are an excellent thing, not just as a medical healthcare professional, but also as a priest. I believe that the designation of an individual to speak for oneself when one can no longer speak is extremely helpful and necessary in the context of difficult decisions towards the end of life. And I would strongly encourage all members of parishes to try to find contexts in which parishioners can be encouraged to fill out advance directives and think in advance, particularly of individuals who they would like to designate as their proxy decision makers. And one should add parenthetically that in most large parishes, there are often people in the healthcare professions, often nurses, even more than physicians, who would be willing, even ecstatic, to be offered an opportunity to make a presentation, say, to an RCIA program or to a Bible study group or in general to a community of say retired individuals if they have a particular group that meets within the parish. So I'm very much in favor of advance directives, and that will probably come out in the course of this discussion. We begin noting that there are no official magisterial, that is to say no Roman, papal, or congregational declarations describing the right of Catholics to create advance directives, that is to say to create documents that give instructions on what is to be done when an individual can no longer express their wishes. But as we'll see, the Catechism clearly reaffirms Pius XII's statements regarding free and informed consent where medical procedures and especially experiments are concerned. And the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, in their ethical and religious directives, have made it clear that advance directives are to be encouraged and to be respected. So let's look first at the Catechism of the Catholic Church, beginning with number 2292, and here we see echoes of what we've already looked at in Pius XII's presentation to or discussion with the Conference of Histopathologists, and that is scientific, medical, or psychological experiments on individuals or groups can contribute to healing and the advancement of public health. So the Church is in favor of scientific progress and recognizes that this can only occur if experimentation takes place. The next statement, number 2293 and 2294, which are in slightly smaller print, that indicates articles, but not, if you will, main articles within the context of the Catechism. Number 2293, basic research is a significant expression of man's dominion over creation, seen here as a positive thing. But, and here we find again an echo of what we saw in Pius XII, science and technology are ordered to man, to the service of humanity, from whom they take their origin and development. They find in the person and in the moral values of human beings both evidence of their purpose and awareness of their limits. So human beings do not exist to serve science. Science and technology exists to serve human beings, not just in their physical well-being, but also in their moral and spiritual well-being. And this is reiterated in the following statement, 2294, science and technology must be at the service of the human person in conformity with the plan and will of God. And then in 2295, one does have a statement of encouragement of informed consent. Here it does have to do primarily with the context of research or experimentation, which, as we saw, is the way this doctrine began in the 1940s and 50s. That subjects' potential consent does not justify acts that are themselves contrary to the dignity of persons and the moral law. So just because you get consent doesn't mean that the procedure or the experiment is justified. It has to itself fulfill certain criteria. And as it states in the concluding section of this, number 2295, experimentation on human beings does not conform to the dignity of the person if it takes place without informed consent of the person or those who legitimately speak for them. So informed consent is presumed in anything that involves research or experimentation. Now, The next section is not from Rome, but from the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, the so-called ERDs, the Ethical and Religious Directives for Catholic Healthcare Services. As we've mentioned, these are the criteria, the documents that must be followed in any institution that wishes to describe itself as Catholic. And in numbers 23 through 28, we find statements of direct relevance to the question of advanced directives. Number 23, the inherent dignity of the human person must be respected and protected, and this extends to all persons served by Catholic healthcare. And then number 24, in compliance with federal law, a Catholic healthcare institution will make available to patient information about their rights under the laws of their state to make an advance directive for their medical treatment. So this is not an option, it is a requirement. Catholic institutions will let people know about their right to make an advance directive. However, the institution will not honor a directive that is contrary to Catholic teaching. That is, if a person attempts to use a directive as a way of coercing healthcare professionals to engage in euthanasic acts, acts intended directly to end their life, the institution is not obliged to follow those directives, and indeed would not be obliged to follow them even if it weren't a Catholic institution. So, number 25, each person may identify in advance a representative to make healthcare decisions as his or her surrogate. And as we'll see, this is the most important, the most effective form of advance directive. Not an attempt to describe everything that could happen and to list one's response to those horrible scenarios, but instead to find a living, breathing human being whose decision-making processes and spiritual values one trusts. And decisions, in number 25, by the designated surrogate should be faithful to Catholic moral principles and to the person's intentions and values. Or, if we don't know those values, then to the person's best interests. And this is a hierarchy of decision-making based, first of all, on the person's own wishes, and then if the person's wishes can't be known, then to what is regarded as what one tries to determine is, in fact, in the person's best interests. And this is usually respected in most states. In the event that an advance directive is not executed, those who are in a position to know best the patient's wishes should participate in the treatment decisions. Now, these are usually family members and loved ones, but they are not always family members. If a person has been living apart from their family for decades or is alienated and estranged from them, it may well be that some new community or some new individual, perhaps their spouse or friends that they've formed, may know better what it is they wish. And in some states, particularly in California, then those individuals' wishes will be respected above those of the family. Now, it varies from state to state. Some states have hierarchies of family members who are entitled to make decisions if there is no advance directive. But in other states, such as California, there is no such hierarchy, and the decisions are to be made by those who are in a position to know the individual's wishes, regardless of whether they are related to the individual. So this is an acknowledgement of that approach. And number 26, the free and informed consent of the person or the person's surrogate is required for medical treatments and procedures except in an emergency. So here is what we've seen, is the application of the principle of informed consent to cover everything that is done for the individual except when it involves a life-threatening emergency. And in number 27, there's a very good description of what free and informed consent necessitates. The person or the person's surrogate has to receive all reasonable information about the essential nature of the proposed treatment. And again, notice this is not experimental treatment. This is any treatment. And its benefits, risks, side effects, consequences, cost. Any reasonable or morally legitimate alternatives, including the alternative of not being treated. What would be the effect if the individual is not treated? And finally, in number 28, the free and informed healthcare decision of the person or the person's surrogate is to be followed as long as it does not contradict Catholic principles, a kind of a restatement of what we've already seen in number 24. We'll conclude this section by looking at three different forms of advance directives and, of course, the precise names and designations of these forms will vary from state to state. The oldest and least useful form of an advance directive is number three, the living will. And this was an attempt on the part of an individual to anticipate the various things that might happen to them and to, in advance, write down what they want to be done. But as we'll see when we look at a particular case that's recommended by the American Medical Association for study of this question of informed consent, it really is impossible to anticipate all the possible scenarios, all the terrible things that might happen, and in advance to make decisions about them, because there are a variety of contingencies. What if there is a certain percent probability of return to normal function, but there's also a very significant probability that one would become permanently disabled? These are very difficult things to correctly anticipate, and certainly it's almost impossible to associate them with a percentile, with a percentage of probability, and then a decision made in advance, because one can't know the other circumstances that might be present. How debilitated am I? How am I less aware of my surroundings than I once was? There are a lot of factors that might intrude and make a living will really very difficult to create, and then even more difficult to interpret. Having been a part of an ethics board that attempted to create a very specifically Catholic version of an advance directive a number of years ago, and quite a number of dioceses do have available Catholic versions of advance directives that try to summarize Catholic teaching on end-of-life issues, and these can be extremely valuable, extremely helpful, and it's best to check with one's own diocese to see if they are available. But one of the questions arose whether or not one should include a statement in the document, and if I hereby have stated anything that is not in accordance with Catholic teaching, I hereby withdraw that statement. The difficulty is that it may be extremely difficult to adjudicate this kind of a document. If an individual has tried to state everything in advance, it would require a bank of moral theologians and of physicians to try to determine whether or not the person's anticipation actually conformed to the reality that the individual was in at the time. So, as you can imagine, I really don't believe that living wills are particularly helpful except for a general statement of the individual's intentions and hopes. Far more important and valuable is what is listed here on number four, and I've not given the actual form, but just a description of it, a durable power of attorney, or whatever it's called in your state. Basically, the designation of a proxy decision-maker, of an agent, that is to say, another person, who will be able to speak for you when you cannot speak for yourself. And here again, the goal is to find someone who respects your ethical values, your religious and spiritual values, and whose decision-making processes you respect. The question sometimes arises morally, is one always obliged to choose one's spouse? And the answer is no. Some individuals might decide that their spouse is the one person who, if things became complex, difficult, and life-threatening, would be least capable of making a rational decision, and in that circumstance it would be most compassionate and understandable and just to choose someone else. But if that decision is made, it is important to communicate that decision to the spouse. You don't want your spouse to be discovering to their astonishment and their horror that you've actually designated someone else when they were laboring under the delusion that they were going to be the one to make decisions for you. So one tries to find a living, breathing, trustworthy human being who can speak for one when one can no longer speak for oneself. And in many states, this designation can be done quite easily. In many states, it does not require any kind of a notarized statement. It's simply something that has to be put into writing, witnessed, and dated. Although there is the restriction in many, if not most, states that this decision maker should not be one's primary health care provider. So with that exception, and one might add also, it's also not very wise to designate someone who is likely to benefit from one's death, not because they would be necessarily impaired in being able to make a good decision, but because there could arise legal questions of a conflict of interest, and they should be spared being put in that position if they're going to be a major beneficiary in your will. So, the only other document that I want us to be aware of is one that has arisen relatively recently, and that's marked as number 5, and that is the POLST, the POLST, which stands for Physician's Orders for Life-Sustaining Treatment. This is becoming common in many states of the U.S., and it is effectively an attempt to state which forms of life support one does not wish to use, that's the primary use to which it's put, and have this signed, this request signed by a licensed physician who knows the patient's condition. Now, the circumstance in which this arises is someone who, for some reason, often because they are reaching the end of life, or perhaps they have an illness that they know makes it unlikely, if not impossible, that certain forms of life-sustaining treatment, such as chest compressions or intubation, would ever benefit them if they've reached the point where they know that in their diagnostic category, receiving those forms of treatment would actually only prolong the pain of their death and would serve no useful purpose, then it makes sense for them to try in advance to make sure that those particular treatments will not be used. And this would apply to someone, obviously, with a chronic and fatal illness, or someone who is in the last months of their life, or perhaps someone with other kinds of degenerative illnesses that just recognizes that certain forms of treatment would not only not benefit, but might actually harm them. And so this is a statement that the individual does not wish to receive certain kinds of treatment, and it is countersigned by, or it is signed by, a physician as if it were physician orders in a hospital. But therein lies the difficulty. The necessity for this is that people can travel and then end up being hospitalized in institutions where they are unknown and in situations where it's difficult, if not impossible, to contact the people who do know them. So having a POLST with you can let people know in advance that there are certain kinds of treatment you do not wish ever to receive. And that there is a physician somewhere, licensed somewhere, who agrees with this. Now, in general, and this is true in California and in many other states, these documents are required to be observed by the emergency medical first response team. That is, paramedics will not do something to a person if it violates a POLST that the person has. However, physicians who treat patients in emergency rooms or in hospitals are in a difficult circumstance, and that is, they may not know the other physician, they may not know what kind of physician that person is, they may not know the circumstances under which the POLST was filled out, they may have doubts as to whether the person really understood the significance of their illness and the implications of the treatment that they've stated they don't wish to receive. And so, in general, physicians, although they are permitted, and they are assured, although at least in California this has not yet been tested in court of law, they are assured they cannot be sued for following a POLST. Physicians also have the right to re-examine the patient and to make their own determination based on whether or not they believe the requirements or the suggestions of the POLST correspond to the patient's condition and their estimation of what constitutes medical care, best medical care, and the proper medical care standard of the community. However, as I said, these POLST forms are becoming more common and quite understandable, and particularly for people who are receiving palliative care or approaching the end of life. I've given an example of the POLST form that is widely used in California, and you can look at the boxes that one tends to check. And again, although it allows for the possibility that people might well want to have certain forms of care provided, the point is that's pretty much automatic in all institutions where one is admitted for emergency care, and the real need for these forms is individuals who have decided that they do not wish to receive certain kinds of care.